an honor to be here. And thank you, as you said, to Jeannie, and thank you to Lori for inviting me. And I'd like you all to know what a special teacher you have in Lori. There are not, I don't think, too many teachers who would invite someone who is not in their lineage to come and take the teacher's seat and offer them to have Dokusan with their students. So Lori's humility and generosity is greatly appreciated. Thank you. Yeah. And I am the practice leader for a group in far down east Maine. We're up on the Canadian border on the Bay of Fundy. And this period of 6 months, my husband just retired, and so we're going on a long trip, and we just happened to be, the first part of the trip is here in Florida. And so it's my good fortune to be here, and I've always wanted to come see where Jeannie's been sitting all these winters. And and for me, it would have been the first time, probably in a decade, that I wasn't at a sesshin for Rohatsu. And so here came a wonderful invitation to be here and with you and to talk about the Dharma at this very special time of year, a time when we commemorate the Buddha's awakening. So it makes it all even more special to be here with you now. Lori generously invited me to talk about this book, Zen Teachings in Challenging Times. And I know you have, some of you have read some of it. And it's a compilation of essays by Soto Zen women priests. And as it says in the cover, you know, it's about what does Zen offer in challenging times, which are not unique to now, but seem especially vivid perhaps right now, this time of challenge, personal and public challenge. And I was, one of my sentences from my essay is actually in the back, you know, where they quote it. And it goes, we find ourselves in an increasingly connected world that is at war with itself. What does Zen offer as an alternative? So today I'd like to talk a little bit about that. You know, what does Zen offer as an alternative to this increasingly connected world that feels at war with itself? And to tell you a little bit about what Zen has offered to me in my own longing for peace from the time I was a young child. My father died when I was 3, and I think since then I always had this sense of longing for some peace, you know, wondering how would I ever find contentment. And I remember even as a teenager in high school, you know, people sign your yearbooks, and someone wrote, I wish you contentment. And I have to tell you, Suzanne, what I have found was not at all what I imagined. The kind of peace that maybe I had imagined is not the kind of peace one finds who's Zen practice. And I would now never wish anyone contentment. So. So quite a discovery. And I think one of the very valuable teachings that we learn from practice is how to be open to not knowing, how to be open to what is unexpected. And so much of our life and so much of our training, you know, education is all about finding the expected or making the expected happen or, you know, making the right decisions. And Zen asks us to actually abandon that frame of mind and instead be open to what life offers in a different way from what is expected. And the last thing I'd like to talk about is also to connect this to something that is near and dear to my heart and that is featured in my essay, which is the current anxiety I think we probably all share about the climate. And it has been given some names. Eco-anxiety is one of them. And another is solastalgia. And solastalgia is a word psychologists came up with. But it is about having homesickness, even though you're at home, because your home is under assault from development or, you know, fear of climate catastrophe. And I think that we as Zen practitioners have something unique that we can offer the world in this time of eco-anxiety, and very committed to trying to talk about that and work about it, with it. And so I think this finding peace naturally lends itself into how do we find peace in the midst of this overwhelming catastrophe. So the first part about this sense of finding ourselves in an increasingly connected world that is at war with itself. You know, there is this sense, of course, in the political and social realm of feeling great conflict everywhere. But there's also this internal feeling of conflict, right? There's the me who wants to be the perfectly peaceful me, and there's the me who isn't the perfectly peaceful me. And then there might be another me who will train the one who's not peaceful to become the peaceful one, right? So all these senses of wanting and grasping and imagining that I might know what perfectly peaceful Diane might look like. And what Zen practice offers to us is the ability to see that grasping and that aversion. So a grasping for the perfectly peaceful one, aversion to the one who doesn't feel peaceful, the one who feels anxious, and kind of what in Zen we talk about the three poisons, greed, anger, ignorance. And ignorance is often talked about also as a kind of certainty, you know, like a false certainty. And to be certain that I would actually know how to go from the unpeaceful to the peaceful one, you know. So greed, anger, ignorance, manifesting all at once, you know, in this way of internal processing. And the thing that that Zen practice more and more does is open us up to seeing the ways in which we manifest, the ways in which we construct these views of the world, these habit patterns that we fall into. And when we see them, they have the ability to kind of dissolve, you know, like they're no longer the solid thing that we thought they were. Sometimes we have this sense of identity that's so solid, you know, it feels like our arm, you know, like this is a part of us, you know, of course, you know. But then we're sitting with it, and Zazen being our greatest teacher, and seeing these things that we thought were so firmly glued down to the bottom suddenly popping up and arising, and feeling this sense that, oh, that too is a habit pattern. That too is a result of causes and conditions, innumerable causes and conditions in my life and before my life producing this, right? And so then that becomes something else that we don't have to hold on to anymore. And the less we have to hold on to, the more we become open, the more we become available to not knowing, the more we become available to being with that which cannot be put into a blueprint. You know, there's no blueprint path for going from anxious to peaceful. You know? And in Zen, this practice of becoming very intimate with not knowing goes hand in hand with this sense of maybe this self, you know, that I imagine, the self that needs to be peaceful, the self that isn't peaceful, the self, the trainer self, you know, maybe these are all illusory, right? Like, where is this self that I keep referring to? And when we really look, you know, deep inside, consider our experience of the world, where is this self that we think resides somewhere up here? And it becomes a little bit less fixed in our identity, right? And Master Dogen talks about how, you know, I think, Lori, you have this at the bottom of your emails, you know, to study the ways, to study the self, to study the self is to forget the self. You know, when we really start studying the self, we can't find it. You know? And then when we can't find the self, what happens? The self of the cars come in, right? And the feel of the air here, which I'm so sensitive to because it's so moist and warm. I'm not used to that. And you know, palm trees waving, you know, all of this suddenly becomes part of our experience of who we are. And instead of us, as Dobin says, instead of us going out into the world and grasping what we think we need, you know, grasping or aversion, or, you know, having the sense of certainty, instead we allow the cars and the palm trees and the moist air to come to us, you know, and then the world is a little different, right? It's not just our idea of who we are. It is Diane, the sound of color, you know, Diane, palm trees, Diane, each of your faces here, you know? Everything suddenly starts to come forward. And when everything comes forward in that way, there can be like a tendency to want to keep out what we don't like, right? So this sense of, well, you know, I want to be kind of blissed out, and I'm not going to pay attention to those family problems. I'm not going to pay attention to the Sangha problems. I'm not going to pay, you know, just like keep those away, and I'm just going to be with the palm trees. And that's when we get ourselves into trouble again, right? And so the practice is to allow, to be the bodhisattva that stands with whatever arises, and to have that commitment to whatever it is, I am going to be present to it. I had a student write to me this week, which I thought really illustrates this really well. And the student is someone who is very, and has for a long time been very concerned about so many places they've lived in the world being overrun by development, and they've lived in many parts of the world, and feeling the great anxiety and sadness about this, and really unwilling, not wanting to face it, and hoping that Zen would find it, give her a technique for not facing it, you know, to get beyond it. And they had a dream this week that they told me about, where they found themselves in the midst of a world that was chaotic, you know, destroyed, and they had suffered some kinds of, you know, deformities as a result of what had happened, and found themselves in the midst of other people who had suffered similar deformities, and they were being persecuted by, you know, the other members of the society, and this great feeling of despair about it all. But in her dream, suddenly, they each started helping each other, those who suffered the deformities and who were being persecuted, and they each started helping each other, and even though the world didn't change and they didn't change, they felt strong because of it. And she woke up from the dream and said, so I guess this means I should help others. You know, and such a powerful way, right, that we talk about bodhisattvas arise from the cracks of our necessity. So this is something, for the bodhisattva arose for her in the form of a dream and allowed her to confront that which she couldn't before. And suddenly she could embrace the suffering, the despair. And it didn't destroy her. It actually brought forward this feeling of compassion and the strength of compassion. And that is what Master Dogen teaches as well. When he talks about flowers fall even though we love them, weeds grow even though we dislike them. Doesn't matter what we like or what we think. The universes, and it is up to us to allow the weeds in, as well as the flowers, the falling of the flowers, the growing of the flowers, and in allowing that to be part of our experience as well, to embrace it, just like we embrace everything. That is where wisdom and compassion arise, in that capacity to be the bodhisattva, allowing it all to come forward and be part of our life. This is the life that we've been given. It's our karma, causes and conditions forward, and such a beautiful and poignant thing to be that bodhisattva in the midst of whatever arises. I think this is what gives us a uniquely capable way of helping people through eco-anxiety and climate change, because it is so overwhelming and people can't process it. It's like the human psyche can't really process the enormity of the problem when there is no way of working with it, you know, no solutions, this not knowing, and this sort of underlying anxiety, which I think scientists will tell you it is only going to get worse, so we have to be prepared for it. And what we can offer is, and I do believe in action, so our Sangha has an Ecosattva group where we meet monthly and we, you know, we take action in a variety of ways. You know, we make plans and we do them. So not to suggest that this is just about a way of being with it. I do believe in action as well. But there is a way of being with it that I don't think other parts of the environmental movement are quite as able to manifest as we can, as practitioners, that we are willing to be with whatever happens and to know that this is our calling, our life in this particular time. We were born to what is happening, and we have been called to the Dharma and to manifest from this place. Dogen talks about it in his essay, Uchi, Being Time. He talks about it in these kind of, he calls it the golden radiance. And it might sound impossible, like way out of reach. I'm, you know, like, there's no way I'm going to be part of the golden radiance, right? And that's way beyond me. But Dogen tells us convincingly that we actually are the golden radiance. You know? This is actually who we are. And through practice, we can come to being and acting from this place of golden radiance, because it is the golden radiance of life arising in this very moment, without any objection, all of it just as it is. And when we can be present to and open to it, there is nothing but golden radiance. So here we are, you know, us Ecosattvas in the midst of who knows what may happen. But when we stand in this place of the golden radiance, being willing to be with what is, no matter what, I think that is how we teach the Dharma better than through any words that we might use. That is how we are Buddha instead of Buddhists. And for this, I think that we have something to offer the world that I would encourage all of us to consider, you know, how each one of you can be an Ecosattva as well as the Bodhisattva that you are. And just to read this one other quote from Dogen, he says, where Buddha ancestors reach, water never fails to appear. So this water, Dogen uses as a metaphor for emptiness, oneness, the golden radiance, however, whatever word you want to use for it. And he says, because of this, Buddha ancestors always take up water and make it their body and mind, make it their thought. So the Buddha ancestors are us. And when we take up this practice and make it our body, mind, and make it our thought, we will find it everywhere, in every single bit of life, no matter how small or how large, you know, the moon and the dewdrop. Dewdrop and the moon. It's all there. And this is what we are called to do. It is not an easy thing. It's not an easy practice. And yet, in it, we can find the kind of peace that is not what we imagined, but the peace that comes from being present and being able to really immerse ourselves and know that we are the world. Yesterday's Zazen Kai, Lori picked a quote from Dogen's essay about, and just to paraphrase it, on the Buddha's enlightenment, he said, in heaven above and earth below, I am the only one. And some people think, well, that's an arrogance. But what he was really saying is that I am the moon, I am the dewdrop, I am the palm trees, I am the pain, I am the dead dolphin. I am all of this, and when we willing to be open to that, that is the place of real peace, I think. And just to quote the Dalai Lama at the end, who, when you think about all the hardship that Dalai Lama has faced, you know, in his life and the loss of so many friends and loved ones and not being able to return to his own country, and that he could say this, he says, "You have the opportunity and also the responsibility to create a better world, peaceful and a happier world. In order to do that, we must first have inner peace. World peace must be achieved through inner peace and not through weapons." Thank you very much.
So we'll open this for discussion, and it's the same process we did yesterday where people will, and you will acknowledge.
Okay.
First, I just missed the last sentence, word of that quote. It's not inner peace, it is.
It is. Oops. Bookmark out.
Anybody?
Weapons.
The world is not inner peace.
Yeah.
It is.
Starts with inner peace, not weapons, I think it was.
Not.
You can. I will find it.
We're good at waiting.
You're very good at waiting. I'll read it again. World peace must be achieved through inner peace and not through weapon. Not through weapon.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So this sense of all. And I think that's important, not just in terms of our traditional concept of weapons, you know, one country fighting another country, but also how we weaponize ourselves, mm-hmm. right? And how we have this inner conflict. And so being willing to drop that conflict, to drop that sense of needing things to be as we want them to be.
Because we're very tender around the water, but this image of the woman that sat in the tree, I don't remember her name, but that's been coming to me constantly.
Yeah. What an image of bearing witness, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. No matter how painful, to be the bodhisattva of the hell realm if necessary.
Yeah. And then you said the word immerse.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's really strong.
You know, our natural tendencies to pull away from that's what's difficult. And the calling is go straight in. There's no one that needs to be protected. Be vulnerable. Mm-hmm. There's no self that needs to be armored. You can just go right forward.
And when you say that you know, find peace in things that aren't the way we want them to be, so for instance, these videographers and divers, there was nothing alive.
Not the peace that we imagine, right? Different, a whole different level of peace.
Mm-hmm. Or some other kind of cycle.
Yeah, or just the peace of knowing these videographers, right? That what they were doing was valuable, and they were committed to it, and their heart was in it. There's a kind of peace in that, right?
Even they may have taken their lives in their own hands doing that, too.
Yeah.
What is it? Is that a priest? I guess it's more of an experiential question. Actually, my meditation is actually as swimming in the Gulf.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, 2 days ago, I was swimming on the beach and I didn't realize it was low tide.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I guess it's happened before. And essentially, I felt assaulted.
Mm-hmm.
I felt brutally assaulted, both physically and psychologically, and very angry.
Yeah.
And go
through the, all the sugar industry and the, you know, the fertilizers that are used in the farm and blah, 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 the government was producing the laws and regulations.
Mm-hmm.
And so it builds up.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's, well, you feel assaulted. I mean, it's hit you.
Right.
You react.
Right, right, yeah, yeah.
And to step back. Well, for me, it's, everything for me right now seems to be escalating.
Mm-hmm.
Escalating. I mean, the environmental, so, and it's personal.
Yeah.
Because it, for anybody who lives in Florida now, in this area, it is personal.
Right, because right,
there's the
yeah.
Particles that come from the blue algae are cancerous.
Mm-hmm.
The particles that come from red tide also, it's not cancerous, but it also affects people with asthma, and it floats all over. But it's assault, as I say.
Sometimes you actually have to get angry in order to get up the energy to do something. So anger is really just energy. And you can act skillfully on that energy or unskillfully. Our precept is not to act unskillfully, right? But without anger, you would just be complacent, right? So to value that in you, this is your personal call to it. And it is rising up powerfully in you, right? You feel it, you can be with it, and take what skillful action you can. I mean, maybe your group would want to have an eco-sattva group, or maybe that's something, you know, we could do synergistically, where you have your own local action and your own planning, but we all perhaps, you know, could communicate on the dharmic way of being an eco-sattva. This is one who takes compassionate care of the earth, instead of the bodhisattva, the one who takes compassionate care of all beings. Just hearing all of you and your heartbrokenness over this makes me think that you would be a wonderful eco-sattva action group. And you would find a place to put that anger energy into that.
And to answer his question about a Zen priest.
Oh, a Zen priest. Well, that could take a whole Zazen Kai to go through. But in our lineage, so we have a lay koan teaching lineage, which is the same, I think, pretty much as yours. The Sambo Kyoden koan tradition
mm-hmm.
comes down from Harada Yasutani, and in your case to Maizumi, in our case to Robert Aitken. And then in addition, we have a Soto priestly lineage. Through Peggy Hone Chiyu Kennett, one of the very earliest Zen teachers in America. She's actually English, but she, you know, came and set up Shasta Abbey in California, and she studied in Japan. And so the Zen priestly lineage is for people who feel this calling to ordain, and there's all kinds of reasons why one might want to ordain, and there are ways in which, you know, people serve in chaplaincy roles, or people who do, you know, hospice work or prison work, that kind of thing, where it's useful to have a ordination to be able to do that. But there's also the sense of wanting to manifest in the world in this service capacity of priest. So priests aren't necessarily teachers. You know, priests can serve the sangha and the dharma in ways that are less vocal, verbal.
That's great.
Yeah. I know when you cease the clock, so I just
mm-hmm.
want you to know that we're getting.
We'll finish with the four vows of the Bodhisattva, also on that same page.
Boundless, I vow to
study them. The enlightened way is incomparable. I vow to embody it. Sentient beings are numberless. I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to transform them. Practice paths are boundless. I vow to study them. The enlightened way is incomparable. I vow to embody it. Sentient beings are numberless. I vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to transform them. Practice paths are boundless. I vow to study them. The enlightened way is incomparable. I vow to embody it.